Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, May 28th. This morning we hear from the Big Island's mayor as a triple murder case has a community on edge. A manhunt for the suspect is still underway. Come along on a son's journey to find his father's oil paintings while stationed in the Navy here in Hawaii in the 40s and 50s. We learn about the linguistic quest to understand the Okina, what the Hawaiian language can teach us about professional singing. And we check in on nene nesting on Molokai, a bright spot on the landscape as we help our native species abound. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A manhunt is underway on the Big Island for a murder suspect who authorities believe is linked to the death of three men in the Puna area. Hawaii Police Captain Jeremy Scott Lewis said at a news conference yesterday that they consider a suspect, Jacob Baker, armed and extremely dangerous. Take a listen.
At this time, police are attempting to locate Jacob Baker, a 36-year-old male from Pahoa, in questions for connections with this investigation. We're asking anyone who knows his whereabouts or anyone who maybe have observed any suspicious activity in these areas to go ahead and contact police immediately. Again, as the chief said earlier, this male party is considered armed and very dangerous. Please do not make contact with him. Call 911 immediately. We understand these incidents are deeply concerning to our community. I want to assure the public that our detectives, patrol officers, and partner agencies are working around the clock to gather information, follow up leads, and ensure the safety of our community.
And this morning, the Hawaii Tribune Herald is reporting that members of the community identified two of the victims, Bob Shine, age 69, and Cheetah Morse, 79. Two temporary restraining orders were also apparently filed against the suspect Baker last week. A judge apparently denied both orders on Tuesday, citing insufficient evidence. This morning, we hear from Big Island Mayor Kimo Alameda, who assures us that everything that can be done to track the suspect is being done.
Well, I can tell you right now, we are focused on finding this suspect. I mean, we got all hands on deck. You know, what's so fortunate is our collaboration with the state and the feds. I mean, the governor's office have already been in contact with us. You know, we got the county police chiefs from the three other counties have contacted our chief and willing to offer services. U.S. Marshal Services is bringing in a team, and these folks are super skilled in fugitive apprehension. So, I mean, we got police helicopters. We got drones. I mean, we are, like I said, all hands on deck. This is the number one priority of our administration right now as we speak.
Well, you know, we know that there have been some reports that talked about temporary restraining orders that were filed on Friday that were linked to this case. And there just was apparently not enough evidence is what we're reading. But yeah, your concerns about that?
Well, my concern is not there. That's the past. I mean, we're concerned about the future right now, and that's all judiciary, right? I mean, that's state. I mean, we're county. So we're going to focus all our energy on what we have control over. And what we have control over is getting this suspect, you know, as soon as possible.
And then we understand that the community is also keeping an eye out for each other, that there are some folks that are, you know, banding together. And I know it's tough with social media. There's lots of stuff out there that, you know, maybe hasn't been verified. But anything else you want to say about, you know, the community there?
Oh, man, we have a very, very tight-knit community, Big Island, but we're very close in connection in terms of our relationships. And so, yeah, you are absolutely correct. We have social media folks are, you know, that's that's helping us in some respects, because we are taking all leads seriously, you know. But we ask the media and the public to also stick to the official channels, you know, for accurate information. But yeah, no, you're right. I mean, we are folks who we are banding together. Communities are working together, and we're going to get this guy.
Well, it's good news that the other arms of law enforcement have offered to help. And, you know, any, I don't know, dogs on the ground that are helping to track the suspect?
Yes, yes. I mean, we got, like I said, every stone is not, you know, we don't want to hold nothing back, right? So we're talking dogs, we're talking the U.S. Marshals, Doe Care, you know, FBI. I mean, you know, we got so much right now invested into this, because this is horrible. And our hearts go out to the families. You know, this is our lives lost. This is our people. You know, and this is the number one priority. We are not going to stop until we find this guy. And we ask the public, if you know of any whereabouts, you know, to please call 911. Don't try to take this guy by yourself. He's super dangerous. He's obviously not all there in his thinking, and we just need to catch him to protect the public.
Well, and you know, the fact that it, you know, the motive we're not real clear on, but that the violence seems to be random. I don't know. And any other concerns that you have?
Yeah, and it is random. I mean, as a psychologist, I mean, just from what I'm hearing and seeing how this all plays out, this is a psychotic episode. Somebody was very unstable and unpredictable, and that is why we need to get him as soon as possible. And that's why we have all hands on deck, and this is our number one priority.
Yeah, the news reports indicate that, you know, he didn't have a violent criminal history, you know, that there was just small stuff initially on his record, court records. But, yeah, just disconcerting that this has come up so quickly in, you know, three cases over 2 days.
No, it is, and it's very unsettling. And that's why, you know, I feel like our job is to finish this matter as soon as possible, get him in custody, so it can reduces our anxiety, and that's what our job is, and that's why we focus so much on it.
All right, Mayor. Well, you know, we certainly do appreciate your time this morning, and we know that the chief will keep us posted if there are any other developments today.
Absolutely, and so will us.
All right, thank you so much, Mayor.
Aloha.
We have been hearing from Hawaii Island Mayor Kimo Alameda, who's urging the public to be on guard and to be assured that federal and state and county law enforcement officers are working together to track down that suspect, Jacob Baker.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, serving the Hawaii Island community since 1916, supporting Kupuna Wellness in its TV show Seniors Living in Paradise. KTASuperstores.com.
Tune in to HPR 2 this Sunday at 3 p.m. as the Hawaii Symphony, under the direction of Dane Lam, shines a bright spotlight on its own talented musicians, including concertmaster Iggy Jang and horn virtuoso Anna Lenhart. We'll also hear the HSO Overture by Michael Thomas Fumai, as well as the Lark Ascending, Fountains of Rome, and Concerto No. 1 by Richard Strauss. This series is sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Electric, helping residents and businesses be prepared and informed in emergency situations with the Emergency Preparedness Handbook. Download at hawaiianelectric.com/prepare.
Our next next story is about a son's quest to connect with his father's past, capturing the images of military top brass and uncovering a bit of Hawaii history during the 40s and 50s. Nestor Villar's dad, Vitaliano Villar, was a cook in the Navy. It was a job he embraced after leaving a life in the Philippines. He was stationed in the islands here between 1947 and 49, and then again in the 50s. Nestor Villar is on a mission to connect with a part of his father's life that his family is rediscovering decades after his death. Villar is here for a short visit from his home in San Diego and dropped by our studio yesterday to share the story of his hunt for his father's oil paintings of another time.
He was self-taught. So he grew up in the Philippines, and this was during wartime. And so they grew up poor. And when he joined the Navy, he had some practice painting. And what I found out through interviews of relatives is that he was painting to make extra money for the family. He was painting big, large murals, 20, 30-foot murals for the movie theaters in Manila. And so whenever there's a new movie coming out, they would paint pictures, large pictures, and hang it in front of the theater. So when he came into the Navy, and he was a cook, essentially, where when most of the Filipinos at that time, when they entered the Navy, he was a cook. And then his captain, Captain John Holbrook, realized that he had this gift. And because he had this gift, he took him out of cooking off and on to paint these really important admirals, commanders of the time for World War II, Korean War. And he would have them paint their portraits in oil. And the paintings were so lifelike that a lot of people didn't realize that they were portraits, oil portraits. They thought they were photographs because they were so realistic. And so he did that for a number of years. And then when Captain Holbrook was reassigned to come to Hawaii, he brought him back so he can continue painting and putting murals and portraits around Naval Base Station here in Hawaii.
And then your dad died in 2005,
yes.
You said? But you only recently came across some black and white photos of the military top brass that he painted, and so you were intrigued because that was not a part of a story that your family was familiar with.
Yes, we always knew growing up that he was painting landscapes, Filipino landscapes, still life, and portraits of the family. But he had this box, and he had in there a bunch of black and white photos of his oil paintings, and there was a handful, maybe 10 or more, pictures of his portraits, and they were admirals, admirals and commanders, high ranking, no names, no dates. And so we were curious, but my dad never talked. He was a quiet Filipino, and like most Filipinos back then, they didn't talk about their past. And so we were never curious, and we never asked, unfortunately. So when he passed, we got to ask each other, who are these folks? Why did he paint them? We had no story, and we had no information, so I wanted to research and find out, why did he paint them, and who were these people? They looked very important. They had stars on their lapels, and they got to be important enough for my dad to paint. And so that's when I began my research, and it took a long time.
And among the people that he has painted, go down the list. I mean, these are names that people here in Hawaii would know.
Yeah,
right?
Just a few of the names, the important ones. I started going through, and it was rough because I had a picture with no name and no rank. I had to match his pictures with actual photos of admirals on the internet. It took me weeks and months, but I was able to identify one painting that he did. It was Admiral Arthur Radford. Okay, so he painted Admiral Radford. He became second chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff for President Eisenhower. So he was very important. Another person that we found by accident on the internet is Admiral Charles McMorris. Charles McMorris was Chief of Staff for the Pacific Fleet at the time. And he also commanded Pearl Harbor Naval Base during that time period. And then also the important thing about him was that he was advisor to Admiral Nimitz. So he was probably the right hand for Admiral Nimitz. Felix Stump. He became Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Command. And then, this is a crazy one, he painted Admiral William Parsons. Admiral Parsons was a weaponeer aboard the Enola Gay. That was the aircraft that flew over Hiroshima. Unfortunately, he was the one that armed the atom bomb. And then also, he was in charge of overseeing all the nuclear tests on the Bikini Atoll. And then last, the person that really got him rolling, that nourished his artistic talent, was Captain Holbrook. He was the captain of the Anderson. And he was the one that encouraged my father to continue painting and to nourish his skill, and that helped him blossom and continue painting after that.
And I'm sure there are probably paintings that you don't know about that weren't in your dad's collection, but I mean, who knows if he painted Admiral Nimitz, right? He may have.
He could have, because he painted all these important admirals and commanders. And so I'm thinking he probably didn't take photos of all his work. And those are the ones that he took photos of, the ones I was able to find. But as I was mentioning to you earlier, he took a photo of his studio. And in his studio, at the time of that, when he took that photo, he had five paintings that he was doing all at one time. And so that's a snapshot of that time period. So I'm going to guess that he painted more than that, because he was here stationed twice. And so there's a lot out there that we just don't know about.
And what I loved is you shared pictures of some of the military wives, you right. know, and so that gives you another glimpse of, you know, what it was like here in Hawaii.
Yeah. He was very versatile. So, you know, I'm thinking he painted the admiral, and the admiral said, I love this painting. Can you paint my wife or my girlfriend at the time? He also had paintings of families, and he had paintings of a landscape here in Hawaii. And so he had a lot of those also. And it's kind of funny. Some of the admirals had, you know, married and then divorced and remarried. His captain, he painted the first wife. Mm-hmm. He painted the second wife. Mm-hmm. And then his captain.
I mean,
captain,
that's life. That's just how it goes, right?
Yeah. And so his captain actually had five of my dad's paintings, him alone.
Wow.
And the reason I found that out was because I was able to find his grandson, Kavika Holbrook, who lived here in Hawaii, now in California. He was able to show me those paintings.
And then you shared with me that your dad also, you discovered, had an exhibit of some of his paintings at Honolulu Hale at City Hall.
Right.
And so you're trying to track that back?
Yes. As I started doing my research, I was able to find all these articles that he was painting a lot of military scenes and admirals, and he was part of the Association of Honolulu Artists at the time. And he was competing, and he was showing his work around Honolulu, and they were showing at the City Hall, Moana Hotel. And so these articles verified that, yeah, he was painting, he was exhibiting his work, competing with other local artists at the time.
And so I know you've heard stories that some of these oil portraits may be on exhibit somewhere in some building on base.
Yes.
And you don't have access to base.
No, I don't have access, unfortunately. And the thing is that as I read these articles, they have little snippets of information that I was able to gather. He painted a lot of portraits and murals, and they were hung inside the ships, the Anderson. They were in the receiving station here on base and around the base, and also inside the, not the mess hall, but I think the bar or the clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he had a number of paintings like that hanging around the base, and I would love to find those. So.
Well, I understand that of the collection that you have, that you pretty much identified all except for one. Is that correct?
Yes, I was able to, it took a while to match his paintings with an actual black and white photo of an admiral or commander during the 40s and 50s. And there's one that I put out there that I can't match because I can't say 100% that it's this particular admiral. He was a two-star admiral when he painted the portrait. And I'm going to guess that he was important.
Okay.
And so, you know, I have an idea who it might be, but I can't confirm it. That's a thing.
Okay. All right. But you're looking for clues.
Right.
Looking for clues. And you don't know if he had maybe painted, you know, army generals or marine generals.
Mm-hmm. Yes. He was pretty versatile. He had a painting of two aviators getting communion in front of a priest and ships that were firing off cannons, so naval portraits. And then he also had a painting that he displayed at City Hall. It was a large painting of the capture of German U-boat U-505. And that was displayed at City Hall and then eventually ended up being displayed at the Naval Base Receiving Station.
Wow. Okay. So you would like to know more about your father's paintings, where they're at.
Right.
And, you know, there may be other military families with ties to Hawaii that have them in their homes.
Yes. I'd like to find more, but I also like to bring back his work here in Hawaii.
Yeah. And then have you been able to track down any of his shipmates at all?
Yes, I was able to track down a couple of his shipmates, and I was able to find one painting that he did of one of his shipmates' wives, and that was shown at the exhibit in San Diego. And then tomorrow, that's why I'm here this week, is I was able to find my brother's Nino, his godfather, and he's still alive, a shipmate, and he's 96, Jose Monzon. And I was able to get in touch with his son, Dodi Monzon, and I'm going to visit for the first time and meet him. And he happens to have one of my dad's still life. So I'm continuing to find these paintings. It's just remarkable.
Yeah, well, we appreciate that you've been able to share this story with us and your journey as you discover, you know, a part of your father's story that hadn't come to light.
Yeah, definitely. It's a story that I felt needed to be told and didn't want it to get lost.
Well, we thank you again for spending time with us. And hopefully our listeners out there, you know, can help you with some more clues.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
That was Nestor Villar, son of Vitaliano Villar, a former Navy cook who happened to be a gifted painter who was tasked with capturing the images of military commanders during the 1940s and 1950s here in Hawaii. We have reached out to the various military branches, so stay tuned.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the Master of Human Resources Management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
What is it that makes humans human? The answer is complicated.
One of the things I've been most interested over my career is trying to figure out what is actually pan-human and what is just the particular societies that we grow up in.
The surprising ways in which culture shapes our bodies and our minds. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today's quiz tests your knowledge of a widespread martial art first introduced to Hawaii in the 1920s. Kentsu Yabu was born in Okinawa in 1866. His family ranked in the middle aristocracy, Yabo's grandfather was the archery instructor for a lord, while his father was a court calligrapher. A natural fighter, Yabo became one of the first Okinawans to enlist voluntarily in the Japanese army and became the first Okinawan promoted to the rank of lieutenant. After his military service, he became an instructor at a martial arts school. Yabo's son immigrated to Hawaii and then California. When he had children of his own, Kentsu Yabo came out to visit before spending nearly 9 months in the territory of Hawaii in 1927. There, he gave two public exhibitions at the Nu'uanu YMCA, where he displayed holds and poses, including kusanku, goshu shiho, naihanchi, and sanchin. For today's quiz, can you name the martial art that Yabo introduced to Hawaii? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nairit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NairitHawaii.com.
Is the sound of silence? That's the question that linguistic researchers set out to answer in a new study of the Hawaiian language, or Olelo Hawaii. They wondered, how do fluent speakers pronounce the okina when it comes at the beginning of a word? Two of the scientists from New York University spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about the new research. Lisa Davidson is a professor. Kevin Roon is a research scientist. Davidson studies okina, also known as glottal stop. Unlike most sounds, it's not made with tongue, lips, or teeth. Rather, your vocal folds create the pause in a phrase like, uh-oh. Davidson starts us off.
When we look at revitalized languages, there's very likely going to be some kind of effect of the other language of the community or the other languages of the community. And so when we started looking at today's speakers of Olelo Hawaii, we were wondering, you know, how sounds that are unique to Olelo Hawaii are produced and whether they are affected by English, right? By what we might assume would be coming from English versus what is unique to the language. And that was the point of this particular study.
Kevin, chime in here. How did you get involved in this project and what about it interested you?
I have sort of come at it from the perspective of someone just interested in voice in general. My background is in linguistics, actually. I have my PhD from NYU, and I've always looked at the articulation of speech, specifically how we use the tongue and the teeth and the velum and all these other parts of the vocal tract that people typically think of as making speech sounds. Meanwhile, I've always had an interest in singing, especially, and there are lots of, there's a different literature that exists in the singing pedagogy world about how certain things happen, and they focus really strongly on what happens at the glottis, in the larynx, during singing. And it turns out that a lot of the questions that we're tackling with this project actually have a lot of relevance and draw a lot on literature from the singing world as well. So it was a really neat way to bring together two things that I've always had a professional interest and a personal interest in this professional context.
Oh my gosh. Tell me more about how Olelo Hawaii and understanding the okina can influence how singers train and practice.
Well, so it turns out there's an author, a Spanish singing pedagogue, basically from the late 1800s, I believe, Garcia, who was a pretty insightful writer and teacher about singing technique. And effectively, really what you're looking at with a glottal stop at the beginning of a vowel is, do you start making the vowel sound with your vocal folds together and then make the vowel sound? Or do you have your vocal folds abducted or spread apart and then start making the vowel sound by bringing the vocal folds together? And one of the things that we found in our paper is that when you have okina at the beginning of an utterance, you start with the folds together and then you start making the vowel sound. And oftentimes in the vowel initial words, we think what's happening, we don't have articulatory data, but what we think is happening is that the folds start apart and then they come together to make the vowel sound. And these are referred to in singing as a hard versus a soft attack of vocalization. They don't think of it as starting with a consonant. They just think about it in terms of what the position of the folds is when you start making a vowel sound, but it winds up being the same thing.
This is actually, as far as we can tell, the first study that has looked at when you have a glottal stop or the okina as a consonant at the beginning of a word like this. How are people making this sound? Like, really, there's no research on this in any other language that we could find.
And the tricky thing that we grappled with when we were looking at this is when your vocal folds are shut, you're not making any sound, right? So you can't really talk about the sound of the glottal stop because there isn't any. So really what we look at is what are the effects of doing that on the vowel that follows. So we're just looking at how the acoustics of the first vowel differ in words and utterances that start with okina and those that don't. We found quite a few. And part of the reason that we were getting back to the earlier question about the potential influences of contact with English, let's say, it struck us as a particularly susceptible or vulnerable sound because it is so subtle. It's very hard for, say, speakers of English to distinguish these, especially at the beginning of an utterance when it does or doesn't start with okina. So if that's also true for the Hawaiian speakers, then you would think quite possibly that it's too hard to tell the difference and they don't bother, but they do. We actually found quite a robust difference across the two kinds of utterances.
And particularly in the context of language revitalization, that is a promising sign that there seems to be that kind of subtle distinction. And just a couple examples of words that start with okina that listeners might know.
Sort of the one, what we call a minimal pair, so it differs only in whether there's okina at the beginning, is aka. I'm not sure that I'm really producing the okina myself. So aka with okina is
to laugh.
And aka without okina is shadow. Actually, to be fair, aka aka is usually how people say to laugh, but aka is a form of it as well.
You also have words like iivi, aali'i.
Yes.
Ilima, yeah. And aa.
Yeah.
Lisa, what questions does this kind of research still raise for you?
So we know that the speakers are producing this difference, which strongly suggests that they also will be able to tell the difference reliably. And maybe that, for example, English-only speakers would not be able to reliably tell the difference. So what we are working on right now is a study of the perception of these kinds of words, which is a bit of a tricky proposition because there's no really good way to do it. Because as I said earlier, there's really only this one set of words that's distinguished as to whether there's okina at the beginning or not. So when I was in Hilo collecting this data, I actually also had the speakers collect what we call non-words or nonce words. I found pairs of words that whether they have okina or not, they are not existent words in Hawaiian. And I just had people read them. And now we can take those nonce items and we can ask people and we play them for people and we say, do you hear okina here or not? Does this word begin with okina or not? And so we're hoping that because the speakers are producing the difference, that listeners who are themselves Hawaiian speakers will be able to tell the difference between them. That's the hypothesis. And also that when we also play it for English speakers who do not have this distinction, that they will probably be at chance in determining whether okina is at the beginning or not.
Are there any implications for people that are curious about Olelo Hawaii, trying to learn it themselves, that this research might point to?
I mentioned that we looked at these different acoustic correlates of words that start with okina versus those that don't. One of the things that the perception experiment is going to hopefully tell us is what's the sort of relative importance of those cues, right? So this will also hopefully give us a better sense of what the really important aspects, acoustic properties of the utterances are, and that's something that's very easy to look at if someone is trying to learn Olelo Hawaii, and they can record themselves speaking, and they can look at what they're doing. You know, if they're having particular trouble with it, then there's a very quantitative way to look at whether what you're doing is closer or further away from what the target is. This raises an interesting point as well, which is Lisa pointed out earlier in the conversation that there's very little research on what the acoustic correlates of this actually are. And if you want to, say, develop the Hawaiian, you know, the Olelo Hawaii version of Siri, then knowing what the acoustic differences are that would enable a computer to identify an utterance that started with Okina versus one that didn't, you would need these kinds of data to do that.
Is there anything else either of you would like to add? Anything you want listeners to know?
You know, we were really delighted to find this, both because, you know, even beyond the language itself, I wondered if sort of any language made this distinction, even if they had the consonant at the beginnings of words like this. I just wasn't sure. So at a linguistic level, it's just great to find that a language is making this distinction between vowels, things that begin with vowels and things that begin with glottal stops, or okina in this case. I'm thrilled that it is present in the speakers today. And yeah, we would love to use the kind of data that we've been collecting and the speakers that we've been working with to build resources for folks who are learning Hawaiian to explain some of these phonetic patterns so that they would have, you know, information about how to, you know, if you're learning the language and you want to pronounce it like the proficient speakers, what do you need to focus on? Right. So these would be things that were geared toward adults who are learners of the language, right? People who wish to learn, you know, maybe at once they're out of school. Yeah. So part of the project that we're working on hopefully will be to make some resources like this available to people who, you know, are interested in learning more about the sound structure of the language.
And I get back to the topic that you brought up earlier when you asked why I got into this in the first place. I think another wonderful thing I'd love people to realize is that there's always these sort of unanticipated benefits of looking at something. So, you know, we hope that this helps with revitalization and the basic science of phonetics and everything else. But then all of a sudden you discover, wait, this actually, because of this one thing that Hawaiian does in a particular way that not many other languages in the world do, we can actually learn more about singing and other domains. Actually, there's some relevance to speech language, hearing sciences, and speech pathology as well. And all of a sudden there's, you know, a wealth of data and a way to study this following an avenue that wouldn't necessarily be the most obvious if you were interested in that thing from the singing perspective, but also probably wouldn't have thought about if you were just interested in documenting and teaching Hawaiian. So that's a wonderful
convergence.
Yeah, convergence and unanticipated benefit.
Yeah, a really cool overlap. Kevin Roon, Lisa Davidson, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having us.
Those were New York University linguistics researchers, Lisa Davidson and Kevin Roon. They were talking with HBR's Maddie Bender. Davidson says the pronunciation of okina at the beginning of words in Hawaiian doesn't seem to vary by dialect. We'll have links to their new study on our website after the show.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Department of Transportation, congratulating all graduating seniors. Actions such as planning sober rides home can help graduates live their best lives ahead.
I think that I expected to arrive into a place that felt almost dystopic, where, you know, somebody had tried to substitute human connection for a robot, and that felt unbelievably sad. And in fact, what I found was that Jan and LEQ had built, in some ways, a real relationship that was filling a void of silence in her life.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's Daikin, at CostcoHawaii.com.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the life of Kentsu Yabu, an Okinawan fighter credited with introducing a form of martial arts to Hawaii. In 1927, Yabu spent 9 months in Hawaii, where he gave two demonstrations at the Nu'uanu YMCA. The second exhibition in July 1927 was attended by more than 200 people. Afterwards, the sports writer for the Honolulu Advertiser wrote that this martial art seemed more destructive than jujitsu, and that the talk and drill were highly pleasing and instructive. The big crowd appeared to be duly impressed with the possibilities of this sport. This demonstration inspired others, including Thomas Miyashiro, to establish dojos for this sport that offered instruction to everyone, not just those of Okinawan descent. We asked you to name this activity that Kentsu Yabu introduced to Hawaii. We were looking for the martial art of karate. And we stumped you on that one. No winners today. But that's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
HPR is your trusted source for news and information by day and your destination for music to unwind at night, starting with jazz in the evenings.
Welcome to Evening Jazz on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's time for the real deal. Good evening, I'm Seth Marco.
Stay up past your bedtime for After Hours.
Welcome to After Hours. You're about to enjoy the Mundo Reggae Show.
Well, it's Thursday all over again, and here I am, Jeff Long. The show is After Hours Country Detours.
Then finish off with some tunes from the underground.
Now time for a bucket full of blues, and hopefully you don't touch that dial. We've got thrills and chills to take you into the wee hours of the morning. It's Blues from the Basement coming right up.
HPR is your favorite hotspot, serving up the soundtrack for your evenings. Let's keep moving forward together. Donate at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Today we hear about the comeback of our Nene on Molokai. HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel visited a ranch where the native geese are thriving. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so where is this ranch exactly?
So Pu'uohoku Ranch is all the way out on Molokai's east end. It's an absolutely gorgeous spot. These Nene geese that are living there have the most beautiful scenery to look at. They're living on, or based on, I should say, this grassy slope that's overlooking the ocean on kind of the northeastern side of the island. It's just gorgeous. And as you said, they're making a comeback. It's really exciting. This is a partnership between the Department of Land and Natural Resources, Division of Forestry and Wildlife. Of course, Pu'uohoku Ranch itself is a really important part of this partnership as the landowner. And then also Brookfield, which is a renewable energy company that's been helping with funding and kind of data collection and reporting of all of this information involved in this recovery effort. And so Nene nearly went extinct. I didn't realize that they were this close to not being here at all today. But in the 1950s, there were only 30 individuals left in the wild, which is really kind of mind-blowing. A lot of that was due to, you know, the effects of humans, invasive species coming in, a lot of predation, you know, rats and cats and mongoose. Nene nest on the ground, and so they're kind of sitting geese, so to speak, to all of these invasive predators. And so there's actually a history of recovery efforts on Molokai. Starting in the early 2000s, they did some translocations, so moving Nene from Kauai to Molokai. And they got up to more than 100 birds of kind of a somewhat naturalized population here. It was seemed to be a success, and then it kind of declined. They think it might have been due to drought, you know, kind of lack of food, of course, a lot of predation that we, you know, have been learning about. But basically, the population went back down to zero on Molokai. And
wow.
Last year, they revived the effort. And they're very committed to making this work. They did their first translocation last year, again, from Kauai. There's a large population of Nene there. Brought them over to Molokai. They just did their second translocation pretty recently to the ranch. And they also had three nests of Molokai geese this year. 11 goslings hatched on the island, you know, kind of naturally. And so that's a really exciting kind of marker for success that they have noted in the program. So now there's nearly 60 birds on Molokai. DLNR wildlife biologist Afshin Siddiqui talks about today's nene populations and the goals for Molokai.
So Maui, we have about 580 birds on that island. Kauai, which is the largest island, is 2,643. Kauai Island is also a larger population with 1,070 estimated birds. And then Molokai is our smallest population. So 58 birds on the island, which is great. I think originally what we, for the area where the ranch is, if we can get to 200 birds, that would be amazing. And then throughout the entire island of Molokai. And we're basing this on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Nene Recovery Plan goals. The target for, you know, self-sustaining population on Molokai would be about 300 birds. The goal for this translocation, our first translocation was last year. This is the second translocation of birds. And we want to do this for up to 5 years, continuously bring birds, repopulate the Nene population. We have this area on Molokai that is definitely protected from predators. It has the habitat available. But like you said, these birds, they're not going to necessarily stay in that area. So they are going to be moving around. We can't control where the birds go, but we're hoping that they'll start utilizing these other areas that are in other habitats that we are going to be managing. So that's the ultimate goal, seeing that the bird in these places thriving, reproducing, you know, being able to see them not only on Pohoku Ranch, but on other places as well.
That is so nice, you know, to hear that they're rebounding.
Yes, for sure. And I learned, too, that there's no wild nene population on Oahu. So as she mentioned, you know, these birds are now have, you know, recovering populations on Kauai, Maui, and Hawaii Island, and now Molokai. So one of the big things that they've done to help make this effort a success is creating this predator-proof fenced-in area. It's about 3 acres. Keep those animals out, give the nene a safe place to nest. And, of course, they can fly out. They can come and go. They've also been trapping, doing a pretty concerted effort to trap the predators. That's helped. The fences did get damaged in the recent storm, but they got them repaired pretty quickly. A great team effort out there. They've also been planting native grasses for the nene to eat in the area. So lots of things kind of working together. And nene have recently been seen elsewhere on Molokai, so not just on Pu'uohoku Ranch, which is, again, kind of a marker for success, which is really exciting. They've been seen in central areas of Molokai, even around the high school area in Ho'olehua. Really exciting, but also kind of stressful for the people who have been, you know, involved in this conservation effort, because now, you know, the geese are out on their own. They're interacting, you know, maybe with people more, populated areas. You know, they do remind people not to approach or feed them. They do ask folks to report sightings just so they can kind of keep an eye and make sure that these birds are still out there thriving. Galen McCleary is general manager of Pu'uohoku Ranch. That's his family's ranch. He grew up there, and he talks here about kind of that experience.
We had a large population, especially when the program was first started, early 2000s. I remember there being more nene, but I also remember there was always, you know, a fluctuating population of nene were leaving and coming back. But I definitely remember them as a kid being here, and then definitely remember that population through kind of high school and stuff coming back here and seeing it dwindle. So it's really exciting to see these efforts come back and really see nene on the ground now and the population growing every year as we bring in more birds. And I think the real effort is like trying to keep them and make them a home here and have them nest and be able to repopulate and have that population grow naturally, not just through translocation. I think people are really excited about that aspect of it. It's just like being able to see Nene come back here. And like when we had some goslings, just having like baby Nene, I think on the property was really exciting for everyone, especially, I mean, the crew here was super exciting, but I think more broadly too, in the community, people were excited to see that.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
It is. And, you know, we talked about bringing these Nene from Kauai. I was there when they brought a helicopter delivery of the birds recently. And, you know, it's kind of dramatic bringing them in these crates and then releasing them. It's just this massive, you know, flapping and honking. And as they sort of get used to, when they first come in, they are in an enclosed space that they can't leave from while they acclimate. They come in as a family, a mated pair with their young goslings. And so it is really cool to see. Kauai has the largest population, but also the most genetic diversity. And so that's one of the reasons that they're bringing birds. They've been banding the birds as well to help identify the individuals and keep track of them better. They do put small tracking devices on some of the younger males. But, you know, it'll be exciting to see where this goes, and hopefully they'll continue to thrive.
Yeah, one step at a time. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to hear from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs as it weighs the purchase of KITV and KIKU. What are your thoughts? Let us know. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something? Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.